From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we begin a 1993 Fresh Air retrospective featuring interviews with some of the people who inspired us this year. Everyone on today's show risked their lives to either report on Bosnia or to help the people trapped there. Journalist Tom Gelton and Roy Gutman won journalism's highest honors for their reporting from Bosnia. Fred Cuny is rebuilding the gas and water systems in Sarajevo. Susan Sontag directed a production of Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo. And Edimer Kenovich organized a video collective which roams the streets of the city with cameras documenting life under siege. We'll hear from each of them coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, came under renewed shelling today after heavy overnight fighting around the center of the city. The BBC's Bob Simpson reports from Sarajevo.
Fighting has continued sporadically in the Serb-held area of Grbavica in central Sarajevo all day, though there's been no official word of what's happened, except that a UN spokesman said after intense fighting last night that the front lines had not moved. On another front line to the north of the city at Vogošća, the Bosnian military say there was a Serb attack early this morning, and as a result, there has been fighting there all day. Shelling has continued throughout the city, though with less intensity than at some times recently, and there has been sniping, somewhat restricted by falling snow and mist. The city remains without electricity and water as a result of damage to power lines and deliberate interference by Bosnian Serbs. In retaliation, the Bosnian government has cut supplies from a power station outside Sarajevo, which fed Serb and Croat-controlled areas.
Bob Simpson reporting. Negotiators for Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization ended a session of peace talks today with no report of progress that could lead to an Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and PLO negotiator Mahmoud Abbas have been meeting in Cairo. They're trying to resolve disputes over who should control the border crossings from the occupied territories to Egypt and Jordan. They're also at odds over the size of a self-rule area around the West Bank town of Jericho and security arrangements for Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. France has become the fifth country to open an embassy in Skopje, the capital of Macedonia. Lynn Terry reports.
A spokesman for the French Foreign Ministry said the top French official in Skopje will deal with consular matters until an ambassador is appointed. France is the fifth country to open an embassy in the Macedonian capital in 2 weeks, after Slovenia, Turkey, Bulgaria, and Britain. Denmark, Germany, and Holland have also said they will establish diplomatic relations with the former Yugoslav Republic. Analysts say France recognized Macedonia now because Greece is taking over the rotating presidency of the European Union January 1st. French officials said establishing an embassy in Skopje could be more difficult after that date. Greece, which has a province called Macedonia, has opposed international recognition of the former Yugoslav Republic, demanding that it change its name. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 35 points to close at a record 3,793. Advances edged declines by a margin of nearly 2-1 in heavy trading of 170 million shares. This is NPR News. Radio reports from Haiti say that 150 houses were burned today in a slum section of Port-au-Prince, allegedly in an arson attack by supporters of the country's military rulers. Two people were reportedly shot and killed in the attack. An independent radio station said the houses were set afire by a pro-military group calling itself the Front for the Advancement and Progress of Haiti. The Front's treasurer was allegedly killed by a mob in the district after he said that Haiti's military ruler, General Raoul Cedras, was an innocent man. The Front denied any involvement in the arson attack. The parents of a Chicago-area boy appeared in court today after police found the child handcuffed to his bed on Christmas Day. NPR's Cheryl Duvall has more.
The mother of the 7-year-old boy allegedly punished him for opening a present before he should have. The child was shackled to his bed and was left alone at home when his mother, stepfather, and older brother went out Christmas afternoon. An anonymous phone call prompted police to visit the family's apartment in Addison, a suburb west of Chicago. Police took the boy to an area hospital, where an examination revealed no signs of other abuse. Illinois Child Welfare authorities say their department had not received any previous complaints about the boy's family. Both parents have been charged with child endangerment, and the boy has been placed in the custody of relatives. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
New York prosecutors announced today that they've collected $225 million as a settlement in part of the BCCI scandal. The settlement was paid on behalf of former bank executives who were charged with conspiring to steal more than $300 million from creditors of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. Robert Morgenthau, the Manhattan district attorney, said that there may be other indictments stemming from the investigation. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've met some remarkable people this year on Fresh Air. To close 1993, we've put together a retrospective featuring some of their interviews. Everyone we'll hear from today has risked their lives to report on or to help the people of Bosnia. NPR's Tom Jelton received a George Polk Award this year for his coverage of the war in Bosnia. Our interview with Jelton was recorded last April 16th, on the first anniversary of the Siege of Sarajevo. When we spoke, an estimated 1 out of every 6 residents of the city had been killed or wounded. We began with an excerpt of one of Jelton's reports from the summer of 1992, recorded in the home of Ivan and Gordana Knezevich. At the time, Ivan was a professor, Gordana an editor of the only Sarajevo newspaper still being published. Gordana was continuing to go to work at the paper in spite of the siege.
Gordana and Ivan and others in Sarajevo who stubbornly continue to go to work in the midst of artillery bombardment and sniper fire say they do so as a form of resistance. The enemy, Gordana says, is determined to bring life in Sarajevo to a halt. So refusing to stop working, in Gordana's case, putting out a newspaper day after day, becomes a way of defying the relentless shooting. There have been days, Gordana says, when the only 2 things sold on the streets of Sarajevo were bread and her newspaper. But she finds it's becoming more difficult, not because it's any more dangerous to get to work. Rather, it's getting harder and harder just to think clearly. Gordana says she's losing the ability to analyze facts, to assess each day's developments, to look back and to look ahead.
I think that the worst part of it, that we lost any sense of time. And every day, I'm asking 10 times a day, which day is it today? And I can't remember which day in the week it is, and which date in the month it is, and I can't even remember which month it is. And if you want me to be very honest, I almost forgot which year is this. We lost any sense of seasons in the year, and we lost any sense of the future. I mean, I don't know when the spring was finished, and I don't know when the summer started. And there are only 2 seasons now. There is a war season, and somewhere in the world there is a peace season. Not for us here. No,
what do you think, Ivan?
Ne znam, nisam siguran. Šta izdvojiti? Šta budi?
Maybe we should turn the light down.
Turn the light down. Ugasi ovo veliko.
At this explosion, we get up from the kitchen table and move to the next room, further from the windows.
No, I know when you were interviewing Gordana Knezevich, one of the things she said was that she was afraid she was losing her ability to think clearly, and she's a journalist. She's an editor at that Sarajevo newspaper. Has that ever been a problem for you when you've been there for extended periods of time, or do you feel you haven't been there long enough to have that kind of feeling?
It is a problem. It's a very emotional experience to be in Sarajevo. First, you're in danger, just like everyone else is, and therefore, unlike a lot of news stories where the reporter can more or less remain dispassionate, it's much harder in Sarajevo to to be detached from the story because you become, even for a limited period, as much a target of attacks and as much a victim, in a sense, as they are. And so you begin to identify with them. And therefore, when you go to write your articles or file your reports, you have to really be careful not to sort of let them turn into a kind of an emotional diatribe or something like that. And I think that some stories that I have seen coming out of Sarajevo have sort of slipped beyond that line. And a reporter gets so worked up and passionate and emotional about the situation that he's in that the reporting suffers. And it's very difficult for me to talk to my editors when I'm there. I file on a satellite phone. It's very expensive. It's up to $40 a minute, and you can't have the kind of give and take with your editors that that I would normally have in a story like that. So, you know, editors can sort of keep you under control. They can say, back off, this is a little bit too much. And when you just have to file your stories and you don't have the chance to sort of play them for an editor first, there is that danger. You have to... One has to be very careful to keep his emotions under control as much as possible, and it's hard.
I've heard several journalists say that this war is a particularly dangerous war to cover. Now, you've covered wars in El Salvador, the war in the Gulf. What precautions do you take when you're reporting from Bosnia that are different from the precautions that you took when you were reporting from Central America?
Well, I never had protective clothing in Central America. I wear this huge and very heavy bulletproof vest in Bosnia, and a lot of reporters have helmets. I don't personally have a helmet yet because I think there's some, if you wear a helmet, you look too much like a soldier, so I'm not sure that that's a good idea. There were no armored cars in Central America, so those sort of minimum protection measures are taken in Bosnia that were not taken in other wars generally. But there's not a lot you can do. You just have to be far more careful about where you go, and you pay more attention to... On days, for example, in Sarajevo, when there's a lot of shelling, I basically stay in my hotel room. I just don't go out.
Well, I'm sure you've learned to recognize the sound of incoming shells and other weapons. What do you do when you hear one starting to whistle by?
Well, once if you hear one whistling by, you're okay. It means it's already gone by. The ones you have to worry about are the ones you don't hear. They do sometimes come in sequence. So if something explodes close by you, or if you hear something whistling by, you try to take shelter. It's, you know, it's just, it's a difficult thing. There was a time when I was at the Bosnian Presidency building when a shell landed in front of the building. On a group of people, and about a dozen people were injured and several people were killed. And I was inside the building, and I could hear the screams from the people outside. And I thought to myself, this is the reality of this war. And as a journalist, I should describe this scene, and I should even document it. And yet... I didn't go out there. I didn't go out there to see what had happened or to record the sounds of the scene because people around me were warning me not to. Often, as I say, the shells will come in sequence. And I think I might have described it in copy, but I didn't go out there in a circumstance. Some other journalists might have, but I actually tend to be very cautious in my movements.
Did you think it might have been voyeuristic, too, to have a microphone
yes.
turned on so many people who are in agony?
Yes and no. I think one can certainly be discreet in a situation like that. You don't go up with a microphone, you know, to someone who is in agony and record their sounds. But you can sort of stay at a distance and mm-hmm. just sort of make some kind of general recording just in order to... provide a background in this of the scene. But that's not the reason I didn't do it, Terry, because I think that in that case, it would have been... I think it's really important that people understand how horrible this is. And
yeah.
I wouldn't have hesitated for that reason. One can do that with discretion. I hesitated because I thought it was too dangerous.
Well, it's important to do that. That way you're around to record the next thing that happens.
Right.
Is that the closest you've come to being hit yourself?
I had an experience last summer where I was driving. At that time, we still drove from the airport into the city in soft-skinned cars. I had my own car, and this was the day the airport was open, put under UN control, and there were a convoy of us who were going back to the city together, probably 8 or 10 press vehicles, and we came under fire on the road, and there were bullets whizzing all around, and the car behind me got hit, and I saw in my rearview mirror that they had been hit, and I started driving pretty wildly at that point. That's actually the closest that I ever came.
Who was in the car behind you that was hit?
It was a VizNews crew, which is a... They gather tape, videotape for a lot of television networks and sell it to television networks around the world. I think there might have been somebody from ITN, the British TV crew, in there as well. Fortunately, nobody was injured, but their windows were all blown out.
What effect does it have on your interest in continuing to report from Bosnia when someone who you know or someone physically close to you has been, injured or killed?
It has the effect of making me a lot more cautious. On that particular day, there were two journalists shot, and they were doing exactly what we were all doing. They were driving from the airport to the city, and I knew them. One was a reporter for Libération, the French newspaper. He was shot in the leg and ultimately lost his leg. And with him was a photographer for The Observer, which is a London newspaper. I knew him a little better. And he was kind of a cowboy type, full of bravado. And I went to see him in the hospital the next day. And he was curled up in his hospital bed in a fetal position. And he was in a lot of pain and he was whimpering. And there was something about that experience that just sickened me. And, I think there are a lot of journalists who consider themselves invulnerable, and then they are just in a matter of moments reduced to this sort of whimpering mass in a hospital bed. And that really had a big impact on me. I didn't want to find myself in that situation. And I think there's a lot of stupidity, and I don't hesitate using that word, on the part of journalists in Sarajevo who kind of get off on the drama and risk of it without ever taking into consideration how much danger they're really in and how their lives will be permanently changed if they're not careful.
So this experience made you more cautious?
It certainly did.
Maybe a lot of people, too, are trying to make their reputation by doing something incredibly daring.
Yes. But, you know, another thing I noticed about that experience is that those two guys, the day before, we were a press pack. Everybody sort of travels together and gets together at night and goes out, or doesn't go out for dinner, but eats, together and maybe shares what they have. And there's a lot of camaraderie. And the day after that, these two guys are gone. They're just not there anymore. You know, one is in the hospital, one is being evacuated, and nobody seems to notice. I mean, not that many people even went to see him in the hospital. And it was amazing to me how two people can just disappear from the press corps like that and no one seems to even take notice.
NPR foreign correspondent Tom Jelton recorded last April. Shortly after our interview, Tom Jelton returned to Sarajevo to begin work on a book about how the journalists of the city managed to keep publishing one newspaper in spite of the siege and what the struggle to keep the paper alive reveals about the larger struggles in Sarajevo. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Roy Gutman tells us about reporting on the death camps of Bosnia after this break. This is Fresh Air. The first lengthy accounts of the mass slaughter of prisoners in Bosnian concentration camps were written by Roy Gutman. In the summer of 92, he reported that Serbs murdered about 3,000 Bosnians during one 6-week period at the Brčko prison camp. Gutman won a Pulitzer Prize this year for what the judges described as courageous and persistent reporting that disclosed atrocities and other human rights violations in Croatia and Bosnia. Gutman is foreign correspondent for New York Newsday. His reports on the death camps of Bosnia were picked up by news media worldwide. In September, he told us how he investigated rumors of mass slaughter at the Omarska prison camp. Serbian authorities certainly wouldn't take a journalist on a tour of a death camp, so how do you track down people who can tell you the story, and how do you confirm it's true?
It was one of the most frustrating moments I could have imagined in life, because the story had the ring of authenticity to it, but I couldn't go there. I did the first obvious thing was to ask to go there.
You asked the Serbs if
yes,
you could go.
Yes, yeah. I said I'd heard that the place, some terrible stories about it, and I just wanted to check them out.
And they said?
They said they couldn't guarantee my safety. So it was a way of saying, if you want to go, you may be a prisoner there yourself. And I just tried to think of what could I do to find evidence, bear out the stories, or whatever was going on in the camp. And for the first thing I did was I wrote a story about it. Now, ordinarily, one never writes a story based on hearsay, on a secondhand witness. But this somehow had the ring of authenticity to it. And so I said this was not a witness that Newsday had, that I had contacted, but that who had come to the Muslim authorities in Banja Luka. I contacted the International Red Cross. They also had picked up stories of this sort. I contacted the UN High Commission for Refugees, which had many people in the region. I contacted the European Community, who had monitors. I contacted the U.S. Embassy in Belgrade. And from all of these different international observers, I got a very strong impression that the story could well be true, but none of them could supply a witness. None of them had information that they thought was so airtight that they would give it to me. So I, after puzzling it over for a while, I came to the conclusion, with the guidance of my own editors, that I should go to wherever the biggest gathering point was for refugees from, for Muslim refugees from central Bosnia. And that happened to be Zagreb in Croatia, in neighboring Croatia at that time. They were arriving by the hundreds daily. They had no shelter to speak of. And I went there to the Muslim charity Merhamet, and I said, I want you to scour the refugee camps. I want you to find people for me who had been in Omarska. I'd heard by this point that a few people had gotten out, men over 65, boys under 16, that for some reason the Serb officials running the camp decided to let them out. So for, I don't know, 10 days or so, they searched. They found maybe a dozen witnesses for me from Omarska, and they found Mr. Lujinovic, who had been in Brčko, Luka. Of the dozen witnesses, really only two or three seemed either coherent or seemed credible. Most of them had stories, but they just didn't quite figure.
What was the minimum that you needed to go with this story in print?
Well, I decided in my own head I needed either two witnesses from the same camp or one witness from each of two camps. It was just an arbitrary rule. But I felt I needed at least a couple of stories. And then the second thing was I needed, I decided I had to have a picture of the witnesses because their stories were so extraordinary, even if I couldn't use their names. And so that was the... That was the device we used in Newsday. We had their pictures on page one. And I think that alone drove it home, that these were real people and that they had a real story to tell.
Were your stories attacked for not being substantiated?
Oddly enough, they weren't. Because for one thing, just the fact of having the pictures made it clear that these were real people. Secondly, the story contained comments from responsible international organization, including the Red Cross. The Red Cross had tried by this time to go to Omarska, for example, and they'd been denied admittance. And one of their spokesmen said to me, if this is not a death camp, then there's no reason the Serbs wouldn't allow us in.
Well, in fact, you say that the Serbs closed the Omarska camp after your Newsday report, and they dispersed the prisoners to other places. And then after that, they opened the camp to the Red Cross.
Yes, and to the press. You know, somebody in the Red Cross in Banja Luka told me that at a certain point, about 3 or 4 days after my story appeared, they saw trucks driving through Banja Luka full of bedding, of mattresses and bed frames, heading toward Omarska. And this man, who was then the head of the Red Cross there, said, we think they're about to open up the Omarska camp. They had raided a hotel in Banja Luka to provide to find beds, and they were transporting them to Omarska. They set them up in the basement of the administration building at this camp, and then invited in the press. And they told the press that this is where the prisoners slept, in this kind of Potemkin dormitory.
The Newsday headline that ran over your story about your first story about the mass executions in camps was "Death Camps of Bosnia." What did you think of that headline? What did you think of the use of the word "death camps"?
I thought it was accurate. I am more convinced now than ever that it was accurate. Mm-hmm. It was a very controversial headline because death camps from the period of the Nazi Holocaust are associated as, in most people's minds, as like Auschwitz, a factory where you take people and in an industrial method exterminate them. In the case of Omarska and Birchko, as from the passage I read earlier, and also from the evidence that's been gathered in the meantime, we can't say that these were factories, but that people were killed daily, arbitrarily, 10, 20, 50, 100 a day, mostly beaten. Some died of starvation. And that most of the people there would have died if they hadn't been freed by that point.
How graphic did you want your writing to be about the camps in Bosnia? I mean, in some of the articles, you have some fairly graphic descriptions of castrations, of the slitting of throats, of rape. And, I mean, there always is that question in photographs and in stories when you're describing something gruesome, how explicit to be.
I guess from my early days as a wire service reporter, I've always tried to observe the maxim of using no adjectives in my writing, or as few as possible. And basically to try to relate the substance is the most important thing, unadorned, straightforwardly. And I felt that that was the only way to be convincing, that it needed no embellishment, that the stories of the witnesses simply should be told as directly as possible.
Our interview with Roy Gutman was recorded last September. His reports on ethnic cleansing were collected this year in the book A Witness to Genocide. Gutman is a foreign correspondent for New York Newsday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In the second part of our show, staging a play, organizing a film festival, and restoring gas and water lines in Sarajevo.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, daily life in a city under siege. Disaster relief expert Fred Cuny tells us about directing efforts to rebuild gas and water systems in Sarajevo while under the constant threat of sniper fire and mortar shelling. Also, we talk with Ademir Kenevich, a Bosnian filmmaker trapped by the siege, who has documented the war on videotape. And writer Susan Sontag tells us about traveling to Sarajevo to direct a production of Waiting for Godot. We're featuring these interviews as part of our 1993 Fresh Air retrospective.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. In Somalia today, there was an explosion in the port area of Mogadishu. No one was killed, but accusations are flying. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The explosion occurred in a section of the port controlled by the United Nations. Nearby shops were heavily damaged. According to wire services, UN officials think the blast may have been in retaliation for the shooting of two Somali militiamen yesterday by U.S. troops. At least one of the two Somalis died. A spokesman for militia leader Mohamed Farah Aidid was quoted as saying today's blast in the port area was caused by the UN itself, with the help of the United States, to try to lure Aidid's forces into renewed fighting. UN officials dismissed that accusation. The Pentagon is in the process of withdrawing most U.S. forces from Somalia by a March 31st deadline. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The Clinton administration says, regardless of China's objections, the U.S. will seek sanctions against North Korea if North Korea goes on refusing to allow its nuclear facilities to be inspected. American officials still hope to negotiate an answer, but a State Department spokesman says if the talks break down, the U.S. will take the matter on to the Security Council. China could block sanctions in the Council by using its veto, but it has abstained in other situations and could let the Council go ahead. The State Department spokesman praises China for trying to persuade North Korea to reveal its nuclear plans. Israeli PLO negotiations have started up again in Cairo. Topping the agenda is the issue of limited Palestinian self-rule. The discussions resumed 2 weeks after the parties decided to delay the target date for the start of Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip in Jericho. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Officials are cautiously optimistic these talks will finally break the deadlock in Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Two rounds of talks in Norway and France last week failed to resolve differences over the size of the Jericho area and control of border crossings between Gaza and Egypt and Jericho and Jordan. Both sides want control of the borders. Israel fears Palestinian-controlled borders would be an open door to gun running and terrorists. To the Palestinians, border control is a symbol of sovereignty and would mean an end to humiliating searches at Israeli checkpoints. As for Jericho, Israel yesterday confirmed it was doubling the Jericho area it wants under Palestinian control, but the PLO says it's still not enough. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
Two more leaders of the Palestinian uprising have resigned from the PLO. They are protesting because Chairman Yasser Arafat has denied them top jobs in the Gaza Strip when it comes under Palestinian control, expected in April. The two resignations from the PLO's Gaza office follow that of the head of the office, and more resignations are expected. This is NPR News. American sailors and Marines aboard ship in the Mediterranean are receiving a high-tech holiday gift this week, a family reunion via television. This is the first time the Department of Defense has used video teleconferencing simply to boost morale. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
Teresa Harrison had not seen her husband Timothy since the USS Guadalcanal Amphibious Ready Group left port 4 months ago. But with the help of ship-to-shore teleconferencing, the couple, along with their 3-year-old son Zachary, was able to connect this holiday season. Teresa and Zachary sat in a studio at Atlantic Fleet Headquarters in Norfolk, Virginia, while Timothy had a camera trained on him aboard ship, now in port in Naples, Italy. Both could see each other, and once they got used to the 3-second voice delay, they were able to communicate easily for 20 minutes. Dozens of sailors have been able to take part in the holiday exchanges. One sailor got a very special gift. He saw his 4-month-old baby for the first time. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Credit card companies say Americans charged more of their holiday purchases this year than last year. Credit card buying was up 20% over the same period of 1992. Economists say the rise in shopping with credit cards shows that Americans are more comfortable with the economy. They also point to aggressive marketing by credit card companies and tempting sales on big-ticket items. The Postal Service says it handled 3.9 billion pieces of mail during the holiday season. A spokesman says on the peak day, December 20th, the Postal Service processed 281 million items. The spokesman says the holiday seasonal mail was up nearly 4% from last year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials reached a record high today, gaining 35 points to close at 3792.93 in heavy trading. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sarajevo is in the middle of its second winter without heat and with little water. For nearly a year, Fred Cuny has been rebuilding the water and gas systems there. He's directing the creation of an alternate water treatment plant to provide water through the siege, and he's extending the gas lines to provide fuel for up to 60% of the people in the city. Cuny is the founder and president of the Intertect Relief and Reconstruction Corporation, which is based in Dallas. His work has taken him to Somalia, northern Iraq, the Sudan, Nicaragua, Mexico, Biafra, and other places where there is war, famine, or natural disaster. The infrastructure project in Sarajevo is being funded by the Soros Humanitarian Foundation, and Cuny is working in conjunction with the UN High Commission for Refugees. Cuny spoke to us in November.
Without our project, people have to go down from the hills into the center part of the city in order to fetch water and firewood. And when they do that, they come into the area where the snipers are active from the other side, and many people are killed standing in line or trying to fetch the water and the firewood. In the winter, it's terribly cold. Temperatures are sub-zero from the end of October through the end of April. And especially during the periods when there's snow and ice, it's very difficult to walk several kilometers down into that area, stand in the line of fire, gather the water, take it back to the house, then have to go back out again to get firewood, bring it back in, and go back out again to get food and relief supplies. So our whole effort has been to try and turn the system around, to take energy and to take water to the people, to reduce the amount of time that they're spent in the line of fire and the amount of time they have to spend collecting goods and commodities in order to survive.
But, you know, it seems like it would be almost impossible to rebuild part of the infrastructure while Sarajevo is still under siege.
Well, the things that we focused on, water and sanitation and gas, are all linear systems that are underground, pipes. Are low enough in the ground that they're not subject to being destroyed by the artillery, and the gas mains are the same way. They're buried in the ground, usually up to half a meter or more below the surface, so they're difficult to destroy. Now, what the Serbs could do is blow up the pumping stations and the pressurization stations and the regulating stations, and they have done that in some areas. So what we did is look at ways of putting the water into the system where we wouldn't require pumps. We would be able to put the water in at the high end of the city up in the hills and then let gravity do the distribution and not rely on energy-driven pumps to pump water up to reservoirs. So we have some pumps in our system, but they're far less than the municipal system used before the war. In the case of the gas, we've been working at ways of protecting the regulators so they can't be destroyed, and burying them in some places or putting them in revetments that would be difficult to destroy, and then working to try and keep the pressure on during the winter.
How are you and the other people working on this, protecting against shelling and gunfire while you work?
The places we've chosen are relatively safe. We have some protection from the United Nations Protection Force. They come out to the sites and provide escorts, and if we're fired upon, they've done a marvelous job of protecting us and getting us into the armored cars and out of the area. But there's always a risk, and in recent weeks, the sites that we've been working on have been shelled quite heavily. One site in particular has come under fire a lot. But a lot of the work on the gas system is being done by the people themselves. And the areas that we've concentrated on have been the frontline areas, trying to reduce the risk for people there. And throughout the summer, there was a lull in the fighting, and we were able to get a lot of the gas lines in during that period. But in the last few weeks, people working out voluntarily on the system have come under fire again, and we've unfortunately had several casualties in that area.
So you've had casualties. Has your work been destroyed, too, in some places?
No, it hasn't. None of the things that we've installed have been damaged. The places, as I say, we've chosen have been fairly secure, and we were confident that it'll be very difficult for the Serbs to blow them up.
Who's working with you now on restoring the infrastructure? Do you have volunteers from Sarajevo, or did you fly people in?
Well, we have our team in Sarajevo consists of the International Rescue Committee. Has a staff. They have a staff of three expatriates and 45 local engineers and technicians and staff that have been that we found and identified and hired from inside Sarajevo. In addition to that, we have three technicians from my organization who are working as consultants and managers for IRC that are stationed in Sarajevo full time. And several other people are working in the logistics system outside to make sure that the equipment and supplies are brought into the city on a timely basis. But the vast majority of the work is being conducted, in the case of the gas system, by volunteers. What we did there is we went to the government and told them that we would provide the pipes if they would ensure that the people did the work on the digging the trenches and doing all the preparatory work. So the government made maps of where the lines should go and then gave the maps to each of the block committees that have been organized in the city. And then the people went out with their own equipment and tools and dug the trenches for the gas mains. We were able to mobilize about 15,000 people to work on the project throughout the city.
Have you had any close calls while rebuilding the water or gas system that you could tell us about?
Have I had any? Every day. certainly our vehicles come under fire quite often. Snipers have taken shots at us. We've been very lucky. All our staff, international and as well as our local staff, have not had serious injuries or wounds as a result of this. But we've had a lot of close calls, and some sooner or later it's probably going to catch up to some of us.
You're not afraid to go out every day and work? Or you just do it in spite of the fact that you're afraid?
Well, you'd be a fool not to be afraid. We certainly watch the news reports and find out where, listen to the radio and find out where the firing is during the day. We know, the areas where sniping occurs, and you certainly know the main areas along the lines of contact where there's a lot of firing, and you avoid those as much as you can. There are routes that go through the city. There's one road we all call the Trail of Tears, where the city has put containers and metal panels and stuff up so that people who are walking from one end of the city to the other have some cover, and our vehicles try and move very rapidly through those areas. But there is no place in the city that's 100% safe, and every day you do run risks. But this is where the people have needs, and you have to go to where the people are in order to provide the assistance. We can't. I don't feel we can back off just because of a risk. These people take the risks every day. We should have to take them as well if we're going to provide humanitarian assistance.
Fred Cuny is rebuilding the gas and water systems in Sarajevo. His company, the Intertech Relief and Reconstruction Corporation, is based in Dallas. We spoke last November. Neither the gas nor the water system in Sarajevo is operational yet. Shipments of essential equipment haven't gotten through. Susan Sontag tells us about directing Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo after this break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. In a city under siege, where people wait in line for water, wait for convoys to deliver food, and wait for the war to end, Susan Sontag staged a production of Waiting for Godot, the classic Samuel Beckett play. Sontag is an American critic, essayist, and novelist. She spent 6 weeks in Sarajevo this past summer directing Godot. She found only two existing theaters in the city and no functioning theater companies. She held auditions for 3 days and assembled a cast and crew of Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. Last August on Fresh Air, she told guest host Marty Moscoane why she wanted to do a production of Godot.
I have to admit that it was so obvious to me that I didn't even think about it. It is, although it was written, 40 years ago, I guess. It was first performed in Paris in 1952, if I'm not mistaken. It seems as if it was written for Sarajevo. It's about abandoned people, weak, vulnerable people, waiting for something to happen that they go on hoping against hope will happen, and yet it's perfectly clear it's not going to happen, and that's the situation of the people of Sarajevo.
What was it like to work with a cast and crew that I'm sure were hungry a lot of the time, certainly were frightened a lot of the time? Probably many of them didn't even feel well because of the conditions they were living under.
Yeah, what it was that I was pretty easygoing at the start. And maybe I was easygoing all the way through, keeping my fingers crossed that I'd still get a good result at the end. One or two people said to me, who came in and watched rehearsals, it's funny, I've never told this to anybody, said, you're too nice to them. Don't you know a director has to scream at people now and then and be terrifying and tyrannical?
Are you that kind of a director anyway?
Well, first of all, I'm neither that kind of director nor that kind of person, but I knew that I couldn't scream at these people even if I wanted to. They were so gallant and so tired, and they all had terrible stories, and so, yes, I was feeling full of sympathy for them and worrying about their problems. I was bringing them food from the hotel. I'm feeding them every morning. I was taking rolls from the dining room in the hotel because, I mean, however inadequate the food in the hotel was, it was still better than what they were getting. We did have our spam and rice and rolls and whatever.
I was going to ask you, what kind of food were you able to eat there?
Well, it wasn't very much, but it was more than what they had. I noticed how tired they were because they would sit down or lie down every time I stopped the rehearsal for 1 minute to give a correction or suggestion. They'd immediately all drop into chairs or drop to the floor. And actors don't do that. I mean, they stay in place when you talk to them, unless it goes on and on and on. And I wasn't stopping them for more than a minute or two.
So they had no stamina, really?
They had no stamina at all. And the character of Lucky in Beckett's play is a figure of a man who carries a lot of suitcases. He's the figure of a burdened person. And needless to say, the suitcases that the actor playing Lucky in my production was carrying were all empty. And he was having a very hard time carrying empty, very light suitcases, two or three.
They were
made of cardboard, and they were still an effort for him to carry.
Tell us how the play was received.
With enormous enthusiasm. I think it was a big event there. It was a big event that a foreigner came and wanted to stay there and work and do something.
Susan Sontag spoke with Marty Moscoane last August. A month after their interview, Sontag returned briefly to Sarajevo. She plans to go back again next week. In a minute, we'll hear from a Sarajevan filmmaker who's been documenting the siege. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, so you're trying to take the nation's economic pulse by looking at Christmas shopping and how all the stores did?
That's right, and how they continue to do as people decide to exchange Christmas presents or go back and buy something else if they didn't get what they wanted, Terry. We're also looking at a little bit of the politics of the future with the healthcare debate coming. The AARP, the Association of Retired Persons, is one of the most important lobbies there is, and everyone who has a healthcare plan is trying to get the AARP on their side. We'll also have Nina Totenberg's conversation with Mr. Justice Blackmun.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When the siege of Sarajevo started, Ademir Kenevich picked up his camera and started videotaping the war. He organized a group of filmmakers and film students to do the same. They call themselves the Sarajevo Group of Authors, known by the acronym SAGA. These videomakers risked their lives to document life under the siege, taping everything from a wedding to the dead bodies of a family shot down while waiting in line for water. With the help of the UN, Kenevich came to the States last October for a screening of his group's videos at the New York Film Festival. That's when we spoke with him. He told us that when the festival was over, he planned to return to Sarajevo, where he was, believe it or not, organizing a film festival for later that month. Kenevich is a professor of film in Sarajevo. I asked him if it was a natural impulse to start videotaping when the siege began.
I just couldn't be passive. And I was mad at somebody keeping me at prison without any trial or without any obvious guilt. And I just wanted to react on that. Well, my reaction, of course, could be lots of different moves, but I just assumed that the best thing is to try to document what we could document in from our point of view.
What is your typical day like now in Sarajevo? Do you have anything that you could call a typical day?
Yeah, well, we just... first of all, I live in a downtown, and I'm a refugee in one of the apartments, which where I live with a couple of my friends. My house has been captured by those on the mountains because it was out of the city. And I usually just you know, in Sarajevo, you just go on different hunts. You hunt for the water, then you hunt for the food, then you just try to help other people, your friends, your relatives, your father, and so on, to find something, you know. People just roam around, you know, trying to find something, you know, flour, humanitarian aid. We then go to our SAGA office. We live in a kind of commune, video commune, TV, film commune. We just, all my friends, filmmakers, students, some of them are living over there, some of them are just coming in the morning, 9:30. Then we just go. We have a shooting every day, one crew, two crews, three crews. We have editings every day. And to now, exactly this time, we are finishing the editing of a film which we made following the Susan Sontag, who was making Godot, Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo. It's going to be, I guess, fascinating document about how you make a play in Sarajevo while actors are waiting for the food, waiting for the water. Some actors... wives are waiting for the kids, waiting for the eventual support from the outside world and so on. So we mainly work all day long. We just work and try to communicate with the outside world.
If you didn't have work, if you didn't have film, do you think you'd lose your mind?
Well, I didn't say we didn't lose our minds, but... I think the work helps to preserve the control of at least you know some of the parts of the mind, you know. And I think we think under the situation we are in, we just think that it's inevitable to work because we want to not only to show the world now what's happening and. Show the world the state of minds of filmmakers also, but we think and we are definitely sure that we have to preserve these documents which we have now more than 100 hours for next decades to come, because this period, unfortunately, in the place where I live, will be probably subject of investigations for next decades.
When the Sarajevo Film Festival that you're organizing starts later in October, what kinds of outside movies will you be bringing in? What seems most appropriate to show now in Sarajevo?
Well, everything seems appropriate to show in Sarajevo. I mean, we just want to assure everybody that we want to keep on living normally. We just don't want to make any kind of revolutionary statements, nor any kind of new democratia thing or
manifestos.
No. We just want to say that we just are like other people. We never thought nor dreamt that we'll be kept in prison like animals in zoo. You know, so we just want a normal life with normal selection of movies.
Are you going to bring in comedies? Does it feel...
Of course.
Does it feel like wrong to laugh at a time like that? Or does it feel like, well, that's what you need?
No, it's wrong. It's not wrong to laugh in Sarajevo. In Sarajevo, people always have been making jokes. And even now, and the most often they make jokes about Sarajevo. Like this one, the latest one, was the difference between Auschwitz and Sarajevo. And the difference is because Auschwitz had gas.
Oh, God. Filmmaker Adamir Kenovich recorded last October. He held his film festival in Sarajevo as planned in late October and early November at a large movie theater which was reopened for the occasion. According to the Soros Humanitarian Foundation, which helped fund the festival, several well-known actors were ready to make guest appearances if the UN enabled them to travel in a convoy as journalists, but the UN declined. On tomorrow's Fresh Air, we continue our retrospective featuring some of the people who inspired us in 1993. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Phyllis Myers. Our program is produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Peter Clowney and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our retrospective featuring interviews with some of the people who inspired us in 1993. Terry Anderson will tell us about surviving 7 years in captivity in Lebanon. And Helen Suzman tells us about her 36 years in the South African Parliament. For 13 years, she was the only opponent of apartheid in the Parliament. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.